I've been your host, Ed Rusnader, and I'll see you later.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين. قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warns against any possible Israeli military adventurism against the Islamic Republic, saying Tel Aviv's provocative threats against Iran have increased in an alarming rate. The World Health Organization unveils a new team of scientists to revive the stalled inquiry into COVID-19's origins. And in Norway, at least five people are killed by a man armed with a bow and arrows. Police say they cannot rule out terrorist motive. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations has warned against any Israeli miscalculation or adventurism toward his country's nuclear program. In a letter to the president of the UN Security Council, Majid Tahrawanchi said Israel's provocative threats against Iran have increased in an alarming rate. He cited Israeli official statements as saying that the regime is accelerating its strike plans against Iran. The envoy says such statements are a clear violation of international law, particularly the UN Charter. Tahrawanchi noted that Israel was undoubtedly behind acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program in the past. He urged the world body to hold Israel accountable for its destabilizing acts. Kevin Barrett, a political commentator, says it is unlikely that the United Nations take any stance against Israeli threats, as the world body is controlled by big powers beholden to Tel Aviv.
Israelis are once again threatening to commit the supreme war crime, and the United Nations needs to do something about it, because if Israel, and when Israel attacks Iran, Iran has every right to retaliate in kind proportionately under international law. And that could set off a tit-for-tat of escalation that could lead to a crisis. And that's what the United Nations is supposed to be there for, is to prevent such things from happening. But because the UN is so dominated by these great powers that are essentially controlled by Israel, it's not much good at stopping Israeli aggression.
Iran has dispatched a plane load of humanitarian aid to those injured during a terrorist attack on the Kunduz Mosque in northeastern Afghanistan last week. This is the latest shipment of Iranian aid to the people of Afghanistan over the course of the past few weeks. We have a report.
An Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid supplies landed at Afghanistan's Kunduz airport on Tuesday. Iranian officials said this round of humanitarian aid would meet the needs of the victims of the Daesh terrorist group attack on a mosque in Khanabad port of Kunduz province. The aid included a shipment of medicines and food products.
We're at Kunduz airport handing over Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. This comes following remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, to help our Afghan brothers. This aid, God willing, will continue. This batch of aid is being distributed among the families of the victims of the Daesh attack.
The Taliban officials in Kunduz appreciated the Iranian people and government's humanitarian move and promised to hand over the aid to the families of wounded and victims of the Daesh terrorist attack.
We thank the Islamic Republic of Iran for supporting our people in the darkest days and helping those who were injured in the recent Daesh terrorist attack. The catastrophic crime is under investigation, and our intelligence forces are trying to bring the perpetrators to justice.
According to Iranian news agencies, many people who were severely injured in the Kunduz mosque blast are being transferred to Iran for better medical treatment, following a request by the Taliban officials. Nearly 100 Shia worshippers were killed, and more than 150 others were injured in a terrorist attack claimed by Daesh in Kunduz province last week. The attack was largely condemned by many countries and organizations. Iran's humanitarian aid comes at a time when, according to the World Food Program, more than 14 million people in Afghanistan are suffering from severe food insecurity. Based on different reports, about 50% of Afghans are missing out at least one meal a day. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israeli warplanes have carried out airstrikes on several targets in Syria's Homs province. One Syrian soldier has been killed and three others wounded in the attacks. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joined us earlier with more details about the raids.
An official military source confirmed the attack, saying that Israeli fighter jets carried out an aggression at 11:34 p.m. local time here in Syria, targeting an area south of Palmyra, which is in Homs governorate. The Israeli fighter jets destroyed and attacked a communication tower over there in that area, and also killed one Syrian soldier and injured three others. Because what Israel targeted seems to be not just that communication tower, but also several other positions for the Syrian army south of Palmyra in central Syria. Now, this is definitely not the first attack of its kind. Just a week ago, exactly, there was a similar attack by Israel, and also from the same direction. Fighter jets came from Al Tanf area, which is a U.S.-occupied part of Syria in the east. Fighter jets came from that direction, the Israeli fighter jets, and attacked also Homs countryside.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says militants from Iraq and Syria are actively entering Afghanistan.
A number of international terrorist groups from Daesh continue to operate in the country. Militants from Iraq, Syria, with experience in military operations, are actively being drawn there.
Putin made the remark during a video conference with security service chiefs of ex-Soviet states. He said it is possible that terrorists may try to destabilize the situation in Afghanistan's neighbors, including the Central Asian countries. He also warned that the terrorists could even try, quote, direct expansion. Putin has repeatedly warned about members of extremist groups exploiting political turmoil in Afghanistan to cross into neighboring ex-Soviet countries as refugees. Political commentator Daniel Lazar says that Putin's concern about the presence of foreign militants in Afghanistan is well-founded.
No doubt that militants from throughout the Middle East are now flocking to Afghanistan. They regard Afghanistan as a sponsor. The question is how it affects the internal dynamics in Afghanistan, the struggle between the Taliban and Daesh or ISIS or Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, and also what the role of the U.S. is in all this. Is the U.S. encouraging militants to travel to Afghanistan? Is it siding with the Taliban against ISIS, or is it siding with ISIS against the Taliban? I suspect that some Saudi money is flowing to ISIS. I suspect the U.S. is aware of that and is not saying no.
The World Health Organization says it has formed an advisory group to determine the origins of COVID-19 in China. The WHO says 26 members of its scientific advisory group have been named to join the investigation in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The UN body says the panel may be the last chance to establish the origins of the virus. It has called on China to provide data from early cases. The first human cases of COVID-19 were reported in Wuhan in December 2019. A separate team was in Wuhan earlier this year, but failed to find out the virus origin. China dismisses theories that the virus leaked from one of its laboratories. Taiwan is giving assurances that it will not be the site to start a war with China, but that it will not hesitate to defend itself if there is an attack. The island's defense minister, Chiu Kuo-ching, says Taiwan wants to maintain the status quo with China, but it is prepared to counter, quote, the enemy full on. Taipei's growing military ties with Washington have angered Beijing. China says its recent military maneuvers near Taiwan were meant to ward off foreign threats. Taiwan considers itself a sovereign state, but Beijing views the island as a breakaway province and maintains sovereignty over it. A deadly attack with a very unlikely weapon has shaken Norway to its core. A man has killed 5 people and wounded 2 more using a bow and arrow. The attack happened inside a supermarket in the southern town of Kongsberg. One of the injured is an off-duty police officer. The suspect is now in custody. He's been identified as a 37-year-old man from Denmark. Police believe he acted alone, but they haven't ruled out the possibility of a terror attack. Police have ordered officers nationwide to carry firearms as an extra precaution. But they say they have no indication that there is a change in the national threat level. Some may forget that the issue which initially compelled France's yellow vests to hit the streets was record high gasoline prices. The price of diesel gas just hit a new record in France amid across-the-board inflation. Now the question is, will popular discontent return less than 6 months ahead of the presidential election? Ramin Mazohiri has more from Paris.
In October 2018, a liter of fuel in diesel-dominated France hit €1.53. And for the next 7 months, every Saturday in Paris was a war zone of state repression. The price of diesel gas has just surpassed that all-time record, and many wonder if a return of the yellow vests is now around the corner. After the unprecedented corona lockdowns, diesel, petrol, natural gas, electricity, and prices in general continue to soar worldwide. Inflation in France has just accelerated to the highest rate in 10 years. Western leaders continue to insist the inflation is temporary, but many in France say the economic tension is undeniable.
I would very much like Macron to recognize that the French cannot live with this type of inflation. I normally budget €60 to fill up my car, but today I paid €80. All these price increases in so many areas are a real catastrophe for the French.
Gasoline taxes are regressive taxes because they place the same costs on rich and poor alike. 60% of France's gasoline costs are due to taxation. Many drivers wonder if the right-wing government of Emmanuel Macron is prepared to ease this winter's burden on the average household by making the wealthy and big business pay a fair share. As cold weather nears, a 250% increase in natural gas is forcing European governments to take last-minute action, including caps to corporate profits in left-leaning Spain. France's government is set to announce a small one-time payment for only the poorest households to combat energy costs, which show no sign of easing. France uses the third most natural gas in Europe. The persistent price rises and entrenched unemployment may upend Western plans to finally end quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which have produced record economic inequality. Those policies and the disastrous corona recession may have already set the stage for the next economic era across the West, dreaded stagflation. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The U.S. Justice Department has launched a probe into reports of physical and sexual abuse in juvenile detention centers in the state of Texas. The investigation will focus on 5 secure facilities across Texas. The department plans to probe excessive use of chemical restraints, an isolation, and a lack of adequate mental health services. at least 11 staff members of Texas facilities have been arrested over sexual abuse of children in their care. This is the latest in the probes the Justice Department has launched into systematic patterns of abuse and misconduct by police and prison officials. Similar investigations are underway in Georgia state prisons and police departments in Minneapolis and Louisville. Colin Campbell says what happens in U.S. prisons is following laws without respecting human dignity.
We have to remember that we're all humans, but I think that when people are trying to exercise the law to the T without the consideration of a humanitarian aspect, we start to see the machinations of what happens when people are dehumanized, when they're not considered as people, and when there are just people following laws without respect to human dignity. And I think that's what we're seeing here. Of course, under the Justice Department that Biden has put in place during his administration, they're looking at these issues in a more comprehensive fashion, rather than in previous administrations where they would look at people who might be violating laws as adversaries. There is a propensity to do that when just looking at the law or trying to satisfy the very biased views of constituents. When you have a more humanitarian view, a more humanitarian operation, then these things come under tighter scrutiny and there are stronger pushes for these policies to change.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has described the South Korean and U.S. arms buildup as a real threat. Activists in Seoul suggest Washington should provide specific proposals to bring Pyongyang to talks, and the United Nations should consider relief from ongoing U.S.-backed sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs to reduce tensions surrounding the Korean Peninsula. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Opening a defense exhibition in Pyongyang, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un maintained the arms on display provide deterrence, and that it's the United States and South Korea which engage in destabilizing and threatening behavior. Their hypocritical attitude and the U.S. tacit sponsorship continue to damage inter-Korean relations, and their unlimited dangerous attempts to strengthen military capability are disrupting the balance of power in the region, aggravating military instability. North Korea has recently restarted ballistic missile testing, while South Korea has undertaken a massive arms buildup of advanced new planes, ships, submarines, and missiles with U.S. assistance. Activists suggest dialogue is needed to cool tensions.
When negotiations with North Korea were held, North Korea at least stopped nuclear tests and missile development. A dialogue channel should be opened as soon as possible. To do this, the U.S. should present at least some specific proposals.
The U.S. says there needs to be strong enforcement of existing sanctions on North Korea, although it will meet, quote, unconditionally. Some argue sanctions on Pyongyang need to be reviewed at least. South Korean officials have been more assertive in calling for a new approach from the U.S.
According to North Korean state media, leader Kim Jong-un also said North Korea's military might does not target South Korea, and that there should not be another war pitting the Korean people against each other. The 1950 to 53 Korean War ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in seeks an end of war declaration before he leaves office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Several scientists advising the British government have said that the failure to prevent the second wave of coronavirus pandemic was inexcusable given how much was then known about the virus and the imminent availability of COVID vaccines. We now present you an article written jointly by Ian Sample, Robert Booth, Peter Walker, and Stephen Morris. The piece is titled UK Scientists React to COVID Inquiry. The real problem is the repetition of mistakes. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more. After a damning report by MPs on the handling of the coronavirus pandemic, senior scientists have told The Guardian newspaper the failure to prevent tens of thousands of deaths during Britain's brutal second wave of COVID infections was a more serious error than the timing of the first lockdown. The Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, known as SAGE, warned ministers in September of 2020 that the country faced a very large epidemic with catastrophic consequences, unless they took immediate action and imposed a circuit breaker to bring soaring cases under control. but the advice went unheeded and was only made public 3 weeks later, after Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the three-tier system as an alternative. It was abandoned for a national lockdown in November of 2020. Several scientists advising the British government said that the failure to prevent the second wave of coronavirus pandemic was inexcusable, given how much was then known about the virus and the imminent availability of COVID vaccines. Ministers were warned in October of 2020 that the tier system was inadequate and that the death toll from the second wave would reach tens of thousands of people. Between Sage's call for a September 2020 circuit breaker and March of 2021, more than 80,000 people died from COVID, with the winter outbreak largely fueled by the Alpha variant of the coronavirus first discovered in Kent. A first official report on the early handling of the pandemic, published on Tuesday, 12th of October, by cross-party MPs, described it as one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history. It concluded groupthink by ministers and scientists, including a deliberately slow approach to imposing the first lockdown, led the United Kingdom to fare significantly worse than other countries. However, Professor Stephen Reicher, a member of the behavioral science subgroup that feeds into SAGE, said the government was bound to make mistakes early on in the crisis, but criticized ministers for making the same errors many times over. He said, "To me, the real problem is the repetition of these mistakes. We made mistakes at the beginning, but then made the same mistakes again and again." Professor Stephen Reicher noted, "Most of the time there was a consensus among the scientists, as there was about last autumn, and the need for a circuit breaker." He added, "The real issue was not any split between scientists about what government should do, but about what scientists advised and what government did." Professor Reicher took issue with MP's report for blaming failures, at least partially, on groupthink, arguing that the phrase "let people off the hook." He said the main problem was a paternalistic ideology that sees the public as a problem, that sees the private sector as the best way to run the test and trace system, and fails to see the value of public health at a local level. He said the same ideology gave rise to the assumption, rejected by behavioral scientists, that locking down early would fail because people would become fatigued. He said this paternalistic approach, where people are seen as a problem, is one of the biggest mistakes of the pandemic. Professor Peter Openshaw, a member of the government's New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, or NERVTAG, said that early on in Britain's epidemic, few scientists were confident that vaccines would be developed, trialled, and approved by the end of 2020. As such, many early discussions centered on when, rather than whether, people would get infected. Despite the uncertainties, scientists on New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats and Advisory Group, known as NERVTAG, concluded that Britain needed to go into lockdown. But Professor Peter Openshaw said he spent weeks wondering why policymakers had not decided to take that step. He said, "I remember feeling deeply uncomfortable about this, thinking they must have evidence that we don't have, that has made them decide not to institute the lockdown immediately." Speaking in a personal capacity, Professor Mark Woolhouse, a member of the modelling subgroup that feeds into SAGE, said an earlier lockdown in spring of 2020 would probably have saved more lives, but the number may have been far fewer than suggested at the time and needed to be considered alongside the impact of lockdown, including deaths from disrupted health services. He said actions taken and actions not taken in January and February in the United Kingdom, internationally, and especially by the World Health Organization are likely to have been at least as important as the decisions in March. He added, hopefully the full inquiries to come will look into that period in more detail. Meanwhile, bereaved families have called for the COVID public inquiry to be accelerated and for ministers to apologize after a damning report by MPs on the handling of the pandemic. Dr. Kathy Gardner, whose father died from the coronavirus after his care home was infected by the discharge of untested patients in March of 2020, said the government must appoint a chair for the planned inquiry now rather than by Christmas, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson has promised. The Royal College of Nursing also called for a faster start to the inquiry, and Labour Party leader Keir Starmer and the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice group said ministers must say sorry for the handling of the crisis. The Labour leader said the Prime Minister should take responsibility because the responsibility is his and he should apologise. Hours after the first official report on the early handling of the pandemic was published, the Cabinet Office Minister Steve Barclay refused to apologise, telling the BBC, "The British government took decisions at the time based on the scientific advice that it received, but those scientists themselves were operating in a very new environment." In Wales, the health minister of the devolved government, Eluned Morgan, told a press conference, "I'm prepared to apologise to all those who have suffered during the pandemic. This was a new disease. None of us knew how it would impact. None of us knew how it was going to spread." A full statutory public inquiry into Britain's pandemic preparedness and response is due to start in spring of 2022 and will have powers to compel the disclosure of evidence in a way the MPs could not. Labour MP Sarah Owen, a member of the Commons Health and Social Care Committee, which jointly drew up the report, told The Guardian, "It's necessarily limited scope and conclusions. Whilst valuable, showed the need for a full public inquiry as soon as possible to determine the chain of accountability." Labour MP Sarah Owen added, "It's clear from our report that mistakes were made, but people have a right to know who was responsible for those mistakes and how we prevent them in the future." The Relatives and Residents Association, which represents care home residents and their families, said the report proved they were abandoned in the early stages of the pandemic and continue to be left behind today. Helen Wildbore, the director of Relatives and Residents Association, said, "We must urgently learn lessons to ensure older people's rights are protected now. Waiting until the spring for a public inquiry to start will be too late for too many." Lobby Akinola, a spokesperson for the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice, said, "Had the government taken different decisions, thousands of those lost would still be alive today. The very least that should happen is the government should apologize for this. But what families need even more is a rigorous inquiry with bereaved families involved at every single step of the process." Dr. Kathy Gardner said she feared ministers were hiding information about their pandemic response after the MP's report revealed officials had failed to disclose evidence about how they calculated South Korea's more cautious containment strategy, which was not subsequently followed. According to official figures, South Korea has had 2,594 COVID deaths compared with Britain's 137,763. The MP's report also failed to mention the existence of the 2016 cross-government Exercise Alice war game for a large outbreak of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, coronavirus. It warned of the need for stockpiles of personal protective equipment, border checks, and a ready-made contact tracing system. The health secretary at the time was Jeremy Hunt, who was the joint chair of the MP's coronavirus inquiry. The exercise was attended by Dame Sally Davis, then England's chief medical officer, and involved senior officials from the Department of Health and Social Care, NHS England, Public Health England, and the Cabinet Office. Asked about his knowledge of the exercise on Tuesday, 12th of October, Jeremy Hunt said, "It was not briefed to ministers." Appearing on ITV's Good Morning Britain programme, he said, "There was a groupthink that the way you tackle a pandemic should be similar to a flu pandemic. I was part of that groupthink too when I was Health Secretary."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sometimes someone's name is exactly what it should be, like Ruhullah or God's soul. Many people ask, did he know what he brought to the country as a souvenir? But his lovers remind them that he was Ruhullah. During the several years after he came down the airplane stairs, he was here to finish what was left unfinished for the past 70 or more years. He said there would come a day when children in cradles will accompany him. And when they attacked Khomeini's Iran from air, land, sea, with everything they had, it was the children in the cradle's turn who had now become strong young men to stand up with names that were like themselves or even their family names, like Hossein, like Badpa, meaning as swift as the wind.
In memory of Hossein Badpa.
When someone talks about a martyr, it is not strange to hear familiar descriptions. They might sometimes even sound cliché.
For example, imagine that you want to talk about courage, kindness, faith, and good manners of a martyr, as they all had these characteristics. They were some people who were like each other, even in their names. Mahdi, Muhammad, Ali, Hassan, Hussein, Ibrahim, and Qasim. What difference does it make what their names and their birth certificate is, or where they are from? If you can show a martyr who can easily be found among all other martyrs, it means he had something that would make him stand out. It's something hard to do. Here, social, family, or occupational status will not work on its own. You have to look for something else. War is not easy, especially in a battlefield like the eight-year defense. Putting aside the hardships during the war, there are risks as well. Being wounded, captured, or killed. But despite all this, there are things in the battlefield that not many people can do. It means there are some people among the fighters who choose to do the harder things, like the guys in the Operation Intelligence Unit. But there were many times that the fighters would have to remain in the enemy's territory to get the necessary information from the enemy's roads, forces, and facilities. So, undoubtedly, you can say that if Hossein Badpah is supposed to be in the war, he has to remain in the Operation Intelligence Unit. But in the Operation Intelligence Unit of the Sarallah 41st Division, there are still lots of tough things that not everyone can do. And it means, if what we know about Badpah is true, he has to shoulder doing this tough task as well. But what's the toughest thing to do? Giving up your life in the path of God? This was what all fighters wished for. Getting wounded? That's also sweet. What is more honorable than having a mark on your body until hereafter that makes you keep your head high up among those who stand up for our religion? It's obvious that getting separated from the comrades who have been martyred is hard. But you can pin your hopes on this verse from the Holy Quran. Among the believers, there are those who have remained true to their covenant they made with Allah. Then what? What is the hardest thing to do that the hero in our story has to shoulder? That's it. You won't become a martyr. For someone like Hossein, it was a huge disappointment. Just think about it. Your injuries from the war affect 70% of your body, and you ask yourself all the time if you deserve to be martyred or not. And it's only about you. Someone among the people, most of whom have reached a destination and the rest have not lost hope, that they will become martyrs. Yet, this is the hardest thing to do. Finding yourself in the raucous world, especially when your comrades are not with you, is the hardest thing to do. That's exactly what the guys in the Operation Intelligence Unit do, all alone among the enemy forces. That's why, when the war ended and after he accomplished his mission in the IRGC, he decided to start anew. Maybe he thought he had come the wrong way. Or maybe, by creating jobs and helping people put food on the table, he was on a soul-searching mission. Time is like the wind that blows. It both exists and does not. When it exists, the memories and experiences are also there, but when it does not, it means that you've spent your life. But if all of these lead to the right decision, why would you worry that your hair is becoming gray? It's the choice everyone can make only once in their lives, the hard time of going or staying. like Ashura, like choosing those whose beard had grown gray for the plain of Karbala, like Habib. The passion to defend the shrine of Ahl al-Bayt is not something new for Shias. They are born to die for Ali and his children. They are alive to only shout out loud that they love Imam Hussein, so they draw the attention of the people all across the world to Karbala. After Syria became like this, the passion to defend the shrine of Ahl al-Bayt grew in many people's hearts. But those who were from Kerman were a different story. Now, the standard bearer of defending the holy shrine in the world of Islam was their former commander. That was why their honor wouldn't allow them to leave him alone in the new battlefield. For example, someone like Haj Hussein. Qasem Soleimani was not only a commander for him. What could he do? He knew that Haj Qasem loved him, but he was strict about deploying veterans to the new battlefield. But he was worried that Haj Qasem might still remember what martyr Qazami had said. You won't become a martyr. He always felt the weight of these words. They had come down on Haj Hussein like a ton of bricks, and no one showed up to rescue him. When the martyrs of the defense of the holy shrine came back to Iran one by one, Hussein felt the agony again. But when Muhammad Jamali got martyred, he could not bear it. He insisted, but General Soleimani did not agree. He came up with a plan. He took his wife to Haj Qasem. He asked her to intervene. He was right. No matter how determined Qasem Soleimani as a commander was, when it comes to a faithful woman, he gives it a second thought. You know, for Shias, Chador is a different story. That was how Hossein Badpa managed to go to Syria. But later on, when he got disappointed again that he did not get martyred, again it was General Soleimani who told him a secret. So Hussein stayed and embraced what he was looking for. War in Syria takes its own man. Being courageous and experienced is not enough. If you want to be even an ordinary sniper, you need to be someone special, let alone being a commander. Despite all this, Hossein Badpa was a person who easily stood out in Syria, much easier than in our own battlefields. Hussein shone among the defenders of the shrine and was special for everyone in a different way. But Hussein himself was still reeling under those old words. What could he do? He went to Haj Qasem. Haj Qasem suggested that he implore martyr Qazami's mother. She's a mother, after all. If she prays, Muhammad Reza Qazami will intercede, and he will be rescued from the weight of that prediction. It was the better guidance. He knew martyr Qazami's family from a long time ago, but now things were different. He did not know if Muhammad Reza's mother will agree to do what he wanted. He felt confident about Muhammad Reza's mother. But that day, when Mustafa Sadrzadeh was in front of our camera, he did not know that his turn for the glorious moment of martyrdom will arrive soon. What he talked about might be the same peace Hossein Badpa was looking for. The strange feeling of doubt about whether he'll be accepted or not. Hossein Badpa, a war veteran whose injuries affected 70% of his body. He was martyred in Dar'a on April the 20th, 2015. After Hossein Bhatpa got martyred, his body was not retrieved. He said he knew that Haj Qasem would put the veterans' bodies in their graves, so he did not want General Soleimani to be filled with sadness in his burial. That's why all of the bodies returned, except for his. The only thing was that his family missed him. His wife, Muhammad, Fatima, and his youngest son, Ehsan, who was impatient to see his father. Maybe what he promised his wife made them feel calm. He said, "After I die, you'll get to meet the leader."
In the limelight.
Shanghai Cooperation Organization's 20th anniversary summit heralded the beginning of a new geopolitical and geoeconomic order, says Pepe Escobar, a journalist, in an article titled "Eurasian Consolidation Ends U.S. Unipolar Moment." Stay tuned for more. The 20th anniversary summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in Dushanbe, Tajikistan, enshrined nothing less than a new geopolitical paradigm. Iran, now a full SCO member, was restored to its traditionally prominent Eurasian role following the recent $400 billion trade and development deal struck with China. Afghanistan was the main topic, with all players agreeing on the path ahead, as detailed in the Dushanbe Declaration. And all Eurasian integration paths are now converging in unison towards the new geopolitical and geoeconomic paradigm. Call it a multipolar development dynamic in synergy with China's Belt and Road Initiative. The Dushanbe Declaration was quite explicit on what Eurasian players are aiming at: a more representative, democratic, just, and multipolar world order based on universally recognized principles of international law, cultural, and civilizational diversity, mutually beneficial and equal cooperation of states under the central coordinating role of the UN. From Southwest Asia to Central Asia, a real reset has as its protagonist the SCO, the Eurasia Economic Union, the BRI, and the Russia-China Strategic Partnership. Iran and Afghanistan, the missing links heretofore, for different reasons, are now fully incorporated into chessboard. Imperial hegemony, as interpreted by Washington, in its growing confrontation with China, a ruthless Washington has demonstrated that what matters to it now is not Europe, but the Indo-Pacific region. That's Cold War II prime terrain. The fallback position for the U.S., which possesses little potential to contain China after having been all but expelled from the Eurasia heartland, had to be a classic maritime power play. The free and open Indo-Pacific, complete with Quad and AUKUS, the whole setup spun to death as an effort to attempting to preserve dwindling American supremacy. The sharp contrast between the SCO continental integration drive and "we all live in an OC submarine, Gambit, speaks for itself. A toxic mix of hovery and desperation is in the air, with not even a whiff of pathos to alleviate the downfall. Glenn Dizen, professor at the University of Southeastern Norway and an editor at the Russia in Global Affairs Journal, is among the very few top scholars who are analyzing the process of Eurasia integration in depth. His latest book practically spells out the whole story in its title, Europe as the Western Peninsula of Greater Eurasia, Geoeconomic Regions in a Multipolar World. Dizen shows in detail how a Greater Eurasia region that integrates Asia and Europe is currently being negotiated and organized with a Chinese-Russian partnership at the center. Eurasian geoeconomic instruments of power are gradually forming the foundation of a super-region with new strategic industries, transportation corridors, and financial investments. Across the Eurasian continent, states as different as South Korea, India, Kazakhstan, and Iran are all advancing various formats for Eurasia integration. The Greater Eurasia Partnership has been at the center of Russian foreign policy, at least since the St. Petersburg Forum in 2016. Dizen duly notes that while Beijing and Moscow share the ambition to construct a larger Eurasian region, their formats differ. The common denominator of both formats is the necessity of a Sino-Russian partnership to integrate Eurasia. That's what was made very clear at the Shanghai summit. It's no wonder the process irks the empire immensely, because Greater Eurasia, led by Russia-China, is a mortal attack against the geoeconomic architecture of Atlanticism. And that leads us to the nest of vipers debate around the EU concept of a strategic autonomy from the US that would be essential to establish true European sovereignty and eventually closer integration within Eurasia. European sovereignty is simply non-existent when its foreign policy means submission to dominatrix NATO. The humiliating unilateral withdrawal from Afghanistan, coupled with Anglo-only AUKUS, was a graphic illustration that the empire doesn't give a damn about European vessels. The book Dizen shows in detail how the concept of Eurasia unifying Europe and Asia has through history been an alternative to the dominance of maritime powers in the oceanic-centric world economy, and how British and American strategies have been deeply influenced by the ghost of an emerging Eurasia, a direct threat to their advantageous position in the oceanic world order. Now the crucial factor seems to be the fragmentation of Atlanticism. Dizen identifies three levels: the de facto decoupling of Europe and the U.S. propelled by Chinese ascendancy, the mind-boggling internal divisions in the EU enhanced by the parallel universe inhabited by Brussels bureaucrats, and last but not the least, polarization within Western states caused by excesses of neoliberalism. Very few people, East and West, may remember that Washington had developed its own Silk Road concept during the Bill Clinton years, later co-opted by Dick Cheney, with a Pipeline-Einstein twist, and then circling all back to Hillary Clinton, who announced her own Silk Road dream in India in 2011. Dizen reminds us how Hillary sounded remarkably like a proto-Xi, Let's work together to create a new Silk Road, not a single through for like its namesake, but an international web and a network of economic and transit connections. That means building more rail lines, highways, energy infrastructure, like the proposed pipeline to run from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan through Pakistan and India, unquote. Hillary does Pipelistein. Well, in the end, she didn't. Reality dictates that Russia is connecting its European and Pacific regions, while China connects its developed East Coast with Xinjiang, and both connects Central Asia. Eason interprets it as Russia completing its historical conversion from a European Slavic empire to a Eurasian civilizational state. So in the end, we are back to the Scythians. The prevailing Neo-Eurasia concept revives the mobility of nomadic civilizations via top transportation infrastructure to connect everything between Europe and Asia. We could call it the revenge of the heartland. They are the powers building this new interconnected Eurasia. Say goodbye to the ephemeral post-Cold War U.S. unipolar.